Welcome to the Super Gamer Podcast. Welcome to the new Super Gamer Podcast, episode 177. Our guest this week does Games as Literature 101. It is a YouTube series, and it is also a high school course, which we will talk about. We have the games professor, Sam, on. Thank you for being here.
Hey, happy to be here.
First things first, how did your D&D session go on Wednesday? We were originally scheduled for Wednesday, but you had Dungeons & Dragons.
That's true, yeah, and it went well. It's a campaign that I've been running for the last few years, which makes it sound longer than it actually is. COVID made it difficult for us to meet for a while, and then, you know, like, it's hard to get adults in the same room to play D&D anyway. But yeah, it's been going for a long time, and this is kind of one of the last big clashes of it, and it went pretty well.
So you're the Dungeon Master?
Yes, I play and DM, but I really enjoy DMing, and this was like a custom homebrew campaign that I'd been doing for a while, so it's fun.
Cool. Anything you take from video games that you kind of use in your sessions, whether that be like mechanics, story, whatever?
Yeah, certainly on some level. It's kind of weird to say, though, because like most of the stuff that I could say I take from video games took from tabletop games in the first place, right? So, but I will say one thing I take directly is usually video game music. I've been mostly using the Nier soundtracks as background for this, just because I thought that they fit the world well, and also those soundtracks are gorgeous. So, you know, I usually will take video game music as, you know, just for the backgrounds of whatever's going on, and I'll plan that out. I did use the Doom soundtrack in one session, though. It involved a bunch of demons coming after them, so it seemed appropriate.
Yeah, I think the people I play with would love to hear that.
Yep, fun times.
So Games as Lit, as we said, is a YouTube series, but it's also a high school course. It began as you were taking film as literature in college, and then from that, you were like, well, I should design a course that can be taught about games as literature. So can you tell us how you built the course, how it came to be?
It wasn't quite so streamlined as that. I took the film as literature course while I was actually still in high school and attending college classes at my local community college in addition to that. I was homeschooled growing up, so that was, you know, when that approach... There are good and bad things about homeschooling as it's often implemented. I certainly had both of those involved in my setup. But one of the positive things about it is that you have a lot more control over your own learning style, your own schedule, you know, how you approach education in general. And so that ended up leaving me doing well in school and also having a lot of time to, you know, head to the community college and take some early classes. And one of those was a film as lit class. I was, that community college didn't have an English program, which is what I wanted, but they did have some film like minors and certificates and such that I could go for. So I was doing that. And the film as literature class helped to introduce me to a wider range of storytelling, and specifically to the idea of storytelling in a given medium being very, like, specific to that medium, right? Like, movies tell a story in a different way than books do, in a different way from stage plays, you know. And I'd always loved reading as a kid, and I liked movies, you know, I liked all that stuff, but that class is really what got me thinking about stuff other than books in a similar way as books. And just the concept of referring to them as literature, not because you're reducing them to the written word, but because you're approaching them with the same critical eye, with the same idea that this is, you know, a work of art, a positive thing that has something to offer me, and I can think about it in a way that extracts meaning and positive, you know, constructive ideas from it. So yeah, that idea really resonated with me right around the same time as I was playing some of the first games that really made me think about stories in video games, namely like a Halo, Prince of Persia, The Sands of Time, some of the early ones that really got me into that.
Or Putt-Putt so, yeah, Joins the Parade.
And Putt-Putt Joins the Parade, yeah. Yep, also true. Any of you who haven't watched the channel, we're referencing at this point things specifically talked about in a recent video I did about video games, the games that shaped my personal journey of like realizing that games are art and approaching them in that way. So yeah. But yeah, so that class really just kind of inspired me and got me thinking about that. And then when I eventually went off to an actual university, I enrolled in their English major, and this is less true now, still kind of true, but way less true than it used to be. There was no like college level academic study of video games as an art form at that time. This was back in like the late aughts, early 2010s. I graduated in 2013. And they're just, if you were going to college for video games, you were learning about programming, you were learning about design, you were, you know, it was a technical computational study, not an artistic, or not an artistic one. So I was doing my English stuff, but I worked video games into it where I could. My favorite example of that was my final essay in a Shakespeare on Film class that I took, being about applying the same concepts that we'd been talking about all semester about how Shakespeare stories got applied to, you know, another medium, to film, and applying that instead to video games and talking theoretically about how various Shakespeare stories could meaningfully be interpreted into a video game. So I did a bunch of stuff like that, and along the way I actually managed to convince like the lead professor of the English department of the artistic value of video games as a medium. So that was fun. You know, he was like an older guy at a Christian university, and I managed to get him there. So I'm kind of proud of that. But yeah, my final, my senior project for that, I decided to design a course, a high school course for video games, just a literature class, but using video games instead of books, basically. And let me tell you, there were some things that made that difficult, and frankly, that still do. Like, the main thing that complicated the process, and of course, this was all theoretical at this point, right? I was designing it for a senior project, rather than to actually implement a class. But the main thing that I ran into in designing it was realizing that there are no easily accessible collections of video games worth studying for this purpose. Like, when you take an English class, especially like in late high school and in college, you're often going to get like a giant ass book. Wait, sorry, is language okay?
Oh yeah, you're good.
Okay, cool. I don't really swear on my show, but I do in real life, so just a giant book that's like, you know, the greatest American short stories of all time or whatever, right? And so you have hundreds of pages of these stories that you're going to study over the course of it. There's nothing like that for video games. And at the time back then, like, Steam existed, but it wasn't quite the giant it was now. And Mac games weren't nearly as common. And like just in general, there was kind of an accessibility problem. I had to essentially organize the class by genre, or not had to. This is how I chose to do it. It's not how I would choose to do it now, or how I even chose to do it when I was teaching the course. But I organized it by video game genre and had a number of different games that of that genre that could be played. And then we would talk about it in more general. Again, I don't think that's a great approach to it. But, you know, it's what I went with at the time. And just kind of had the course going over the basics of storytelling first, and then some of the more specific ideas about interactive storytelling and how storytelling is changed, shaped, and specifically delivered by having the interactivity of video games. And then from there to, you know, the more specific studies of specific games and what they were saying.
I did wonder, because you have taught this in school to mm-hmm. children, how do you overcome the fact that, like, some kids don't have any gaming system, or some don't have the specific consoles you may want them to use for, you know, for the game you assigned?
Yeah. I will say, by the time I actually, because what happened with that was I finished it, finished college, got out of there, and then ended up moving back to my hometown and getting a part-time teaching gig at the charter school that I had homeschooled through. So I was going to be teaching like a high school and junior high level classes, including video games as literature. And when I actually designed that, they had a computer lab. And so I constructed a new version of the class that specifically used PC games. And I think in that case, oh no, I tried to stick as much as I could to games that were also available on Mac, because the computer lab there was Mac computers, and I wanted the kids to be able to use that if they didn't have access to something at home that could play these games. But for the most part, I tried to stick to PC games, and then in some cases, I just they actually gave me a little bit of a budget to work with. And so I purchased a number, we talked about Beyond Good and Evil. That was one of the games that we discussed. And so I purchased a number of used copies for GameCube, Xbox, and PS2. So that if any of the kids had those consoles at home, they could go to the school library and check out, you know, the game for that console. You know, that school should actually probably still have them. I don't know. I don't live anywhere near there anymore, but they should theoretically still exist somewhere there. But yeah, so that was kind of my best attempt at getting past that. Nowadays, that is relatively easy. There are still some roadblocks there, but like, you know, computers are common enough. Steam is enough of just a giant presence that theoretically you could just, you know, here are all these games, right? Like, these are the ones we're going to play. Play them on your computer. Yeah. That's how I did it back then.
Have you ever had issues where a student couldn't progress far enough in a game to actually say anything meaningful about it?
Not that I recall, at least. Because I mean, to clarify, I haven't been teaching the course for a while. Unfortunately, when I was going through my English degree, I didn't really realize that the only particularly viable career route from English is a teaching, and I should get my teaching credential while I'm in college. Didn't realize that at the time. Now it's very expensive to go back and do it, so I didn't have that. I could only teach part-time as a result, and so I ended up having to move on to other careers. I'm still working with kids, just not in quite that same way. But yeah, for the years that I was doing that, I don't remember that being an issue. What was actually a bigger problem, and I might be getting a little ahead of myself here because this is one of the biggest takeaways from it for me personally, from that experience of teaching this, was that the kids weren't used to thinking about games in this way. I mean, this is... not to suggest that media literacy in gaming communities is solved, because it's still a pretty big problem, I think. But back then, like, the only writing on video games that really existed in the mainstream space at all was game reviews, right? It was very consumer focused. If you were reading about a video game, then you were almost exclusively reading a write-up about whether or not this person thinks the game is worth your money, right? And that's a very, very different approach from studying a video game and thinking about it as a work of narrative art. So I, like, in the high school class, I had actual, like, essay prompts, right? I'd say, like, hey, you know, choose from one of these. Either talk about the way that the player's interactivity enhances this story moment, or talk about Jade's character arc in Beyond Good and Evil and how she grows, things like that, right? And the first time I went through it, like the early games that we talked about, the essays that I would get back were rather largely like, you know, oh, well, the game was fun. I had these problems and a couple glitches popped up, but, you know, sure, 10 out of 10. Like, some of them actually had, like, scores in them, and I was like, okay, no, like... It just really struck me how we are not trained to think about video games in a constructive way, right? Especially back then. This is better now, but back then, we were, you know, like, video games were generally regarded by our parents, teachers, authority figures in general as a waste of time at best and an actively malicious, like, destroyer of our brains at worst. So we were encouraged to play them for fun if we want to, but not to actually put any value on them, not to think about them, not to engage with them on any sort of deeper level, because there was presumably no deeper level on which to engage with them in the first place. So it was a big process of getting these kids to actually think about them in a more critical way and through the lenses that I was trying to get them thinking about them.
I feel like there's probably, like to be, to critique the game's, like, narrative, I think certainly is, like, a high school level thing. But when I think back to myself as, like, a young kid, like, elementary kid, I think if you were to, like, say, assign you know, write a short story about the characters, and you could put, like, Mario, whatever. It doesn't have to be a narrative-driven kind of thing. I think younger kids would be like, oh, yeah, like, I imagine this all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But it is funny that probably does, you know, there reaches an age where that goes away, and then it becomes what you say about, like, okay, now it's about, is this a good game or not?
Yeah. And like I said, I think that that's better now. We have, like, just if you look at the game journalism landscape such as it is, it's still kind of a capitalist hellscape, and there are a lot of problems with it, but there are, at least to the chagrin of many types of gamers, I suppose, a lot of attempts to actually, like, dig into a game in its place in our culture, the things that it's saying about our society, the context of its creation, things like that, as opposed to just, here's my game review, here's whether I think you should buy it or not, right? Like, that kind of thing is much more common. And so I'm glad of that, at least. Again, there is a big problem of media literacy in gaming spaces still. A lot of people kind of want to take us back to that because they don't like some of the things that come up when you actually look at video games through the same critical lens that we look at other art. But I think that overall it's a good thing. And it was definitely a problem back then, just that there was so little of that kind of, you know, relatively academic writing. So people just didn't think about games like that unless, you know, they made an effort to kind of deconstruct that and figure it out.
Something I laughed at and found surprising that you said on Twitter a while back, working with kids again, you said that you've noticed that for children now, anything portable, like any handheld, they just call a Switch, whether it's a Steam yep. Deck or whatever, which surprises me because I feel like that's something where a kid would be very, like, indignant about it to their parents. Like, no, Mom, it's not a Switch. It's, you know.
Yeah. If they had them, maybe. Like, I think that if a kid brought a Steam Deck into the after school program I work at now and I was like, oh, that's a cool Switch, then maybe they would be. But, like, you know, on the days when we have, like, our media time days and the kids can bring their tablets and play video games or whatever, and I bring my stuff, too, so that they can, you know, expand their horizons a little bit past Roblox and Minecraft. Yeah, it's all that. The Steam Deck is the big black Switch, and the PSP is the little Switch. Like, it's weird. It's kind of like what Game Boy used to be, I guess, right? But it's children doing it now instead of parents.
Have you ever had to bite your tongue with, you said on Critical Distance, Keywords in Play, a podcast several years ago, you mentioned there was one student who didn't want to play Bastion, as you assigned, because they thought it looked boring. And I think I'd be like, what are you talking about?
Oh, yeah. Honestly, it was long enough ago, I don't remember exactly, like, what I said to that kid in particular. But yeah, there was definitely, like, your homework is literally playing video games, bud. Like buckle down and just do it. Like, I don't know. I would rather play most terrible video games than do math homework or whatever. Like, you've got it good even if it's boring. Yeah. That kid in particular had a lot of, you know, is kind of a stereotypical, like, Call of Duty teen. And right. Just had a lot of trouble kind of adjusting his thought process to a lot of things. But, yeah, I will say I'm pretty sure that was the only time. I did also briefly teach the class in a more troubled school, and there were a lot of kids who pretty much just, like, sat there, didn't engage, and didn't do anything. But aside from that, that kid was definitely the only one I'd ever had who was straight up, who was ever just like, I'm not gonna play this video game that you've assigned me for school. Like,
it's a game I love so much. I'd be like, you're gonna play it, you're gonna like it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I mean, you know, Supergiant's just 4 for 4. Every single game they've made is like a masterpiece. But yeah, Bastion I love a lot. So that was definitely, you know, that was weird. But
would you be open to doing this, to teaching this in the classroom again? And then if you were to, anything you would change about how you did the course before?
I would absolutely love to teach it again, honestly. Yeah. Like I said, it's really, really hard to, like, once you've already gotten a degree, the concept of, like, financial aid for school is pretty much non-existent. So it's difficult to go back and get the credentials that I would need to actually, like, do it. And I'll admit, there's also no shortage of anxiety on my part about it because I hated school and really don't want to go back to it. But were I to do that and, you know, get an opportunity to teach this again, like, at the high school level, yes, I would absolutely love that. And honestly, I think that in general, I would do it very similarly, because like covering the basics of storytelling and like literary analysis in the first place, things like, you know, structure, plotting, character development, stuff like that, was good, because a lot of these kids hadn't paid attention to that in their actual literature classes, because let's face it, kids are usually going to be more interested in video games or something than they're going to be in, you know, whatever Newbery Award winning book you're assigning them to read, right? Like, I don't know about you, but I hated most of those when I was a kid. Not all of them, but, you know, most of them. I was reading, like, Star Wars books and mystery books and stuff, and then they were like, oh, read this book about a kid in the woods with a dog. I'm like, eh, okay, sure. And I actually got a lot of teachers, you know, commenting, like, hey, they're doing better in my English class now. Like, they seem to understand these concepts. And I'm like, yeah, cool, awesome. But... So I think that the general structure of kind of starting with the basics of how stories work and how we analyze them and then moving forward from that into how video games tell them and looking at video game stories in particular, I think that that would stay very much the same. I think the main thing that I would do is it would be different games, some of the same games for sure. I think Bastion would still be a good choice, for instance. But over time, of course, you know, the landscape changes, new games come out, new trends, new genres. Sorry. That's my mom's dog. I'm taking care of him, and he's on sometimes.
Nope.
I think that there would be a number of games that would be more interesting and accessible to kids that age now, than the ones that I used then. But honestly, I think that the general like structure of the class would remain very similar. I think that conducting it, again, it's very much based on the Film as Lit class that I took in college, but it is also, frankly, just how literature classes work, right? You talk about concepts, you talk about, and then you talk about specific works, you dig into them. And that's, you know, it really should be just like the same thing, but with video games, right? There's no need to treat them any differently. So I think that honestly it would be quite similar, just with some different focuses. Maybe less of a focus on video game genre, because I didn't do the, you know, one genre at a time thing that I did in my original treatment of it in my senior project, but still focus maybe a little bit too much on like the visual gameplay format presentation, the way the video game genres do. And I think that that's not as useful as it would purport to be. In a lot of ways, like whether a game is in first or third person or 3D or 2D or whatever, just doesn't mean a whole lot outside of just like visual presentation format, right? Like, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Before we pivot to the YouTube series, I did want to, one of your, well, your last video there, we had already mentioned the 50,000 subscribers special, and you talk about the games that kind of got you into thinking about storytelling and games and all that. And it did get me thinking about mine.
I'd love to hear what they are.
Well, so the one that definitely stands out, and I feel like they're, like I've been playing since Atari, but none of those really stick out in my head. The one that sticks out is the first Diablo game, where I just, like, I've always been into medieval fantasy, and I just devoured that game. But the one that kind of surprised me as I thought about it, I've said before on the podcast that, like, I'm really into sports, and I really attribute a lot of that to the sports video games I played, because then you get to know the players and the stats and all that. But I think NHL 94, like, there's, just like real sports, there's a narrative you form as you play, and you play, like, season mode, and it's like, oh, this guy is, you know, really good at fighting, or this guy is really good at scoring, and he's having a great year, and he's having a slump. And I think you kind of make, or I made, my own story about these players.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's that actually was something I included in the class. I did a section on emergent narrative, and I had the kids play Minecraft, and then in lieu of like an analytical essay or whatever, they wrote a short story based on something that happened to them in Minecraft so that we could sort of, you know, use that as a springboard to talk about the ways that a game can basically enable us to create stories through our own choices and the things that happen to us in the game. So yeah, that's fun. Good times.
So for that came out a month ago, that video, 50,000 subscribers. Since then, 1 month, you're already over 55,000. So I mean, what's led to this huge jump here? What do you think is really resonating with people?
Well, honestly, part of that is because I prepped the 50,000 subscribers video months before it actually came out. I don't know. My channel growth is weird. I've had a bit of like mental health slump over the course of the last couple years that have really made it difficult for me to get content out as much as I'd like. I've only made like a few videos a year for the past 2 years or so, and I'm working on remedying that. Because I had that one, and I'm working currently on a video that I have completely written. I just need to film it soon, and I'm working on a Fatal Frame 3 video for the end of October. You know, like I'm working on it. Also, just getting medicated, therapy, stuff like that, you know, to help get me out of that. But as for my channel's growth, it's always been kind of weird. Like, the thing they don't tell you when you start a YouTube channel is that you're going to have, like, no one there for a while, no matter how often you make content. Like, I started doing this weekly when I first made this channel, a video every single week, one long literary analysis per month, so every four videos. And even then, it took me years to get more than, like, 100 subscribers or whatever, right? It was specific videos that usually gave those big bumps, and usually not the ones I'd expect. Like, my biggest early bump came from my video on Little Inferno. Like, most people probably don't even know what that game is, right? Like, I would have figured it would have been Halo or, you know, Bioshock or something. And Bioshock did eventually turn into my most viewed video until recently. But, you know, yeah, it grows slow. But at this point, what tends to happen more is that it just grows slowly no matter what, which is good because it means that while I'm having, you know, content droughts, the audience is still kind of growing. I think I've just built up a big enough collection of videos that there's a lot for people to dig into. If someone comes across one of my videos for the first time, then, you know, there are lots of videos that could be there first and lots more videos for them to watch afterwards if they like what they see. So I think that helps to just kind of slowly over time bring in people. But it also can be kind of frustrating sometimes because I swear, I have no idea. Like, I am completely incapable of capitalizing on trends. Every single time I've tried to make a video during a time when the subject of the video was really popular, it's done like nothing. Like, it just hasn't boosted engagement at all in the slightest. I made a video way back when the first Hunger Games movie came out about what it might look like if the Hunger Games were to be adapted to a game and the challenges of, like, keeping the whole negative, non-glorifying attitude towards violence in a game where you'd have to enjoy doing that and what that might look like. No, like, no boost whatsoever. I more recently released two Final Fantasy XIV related videos during the release of Endwalker, which, you know, famously was such a popular expansion that they had to, that like the servers were getting overcrowded and they had to cancel the free trial for months just so that people could actually play the dang game. Nothing. Like, it's weird. I genuinely have no idea how to do that. So I just make videos on games that I think would be interesting to talk about and go from there. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, the short answer for that specific thing was that I'd already had more than 50,000 by the time I put that video out because it took me too long to actually make it. But in general, yeah, engagement works weird with my channel and I don't fully understand it.
Well, I can certainly empathize with the mental health thing and not getting content out. This version of the podcast, so I started this originally, oh God, like 10 years ago. Mm. But I definitely, yeah, had mental health things weighing on me and episodes weren't really coming out timely and it just was very hard to get a rhythm going. So I nixed it, you know, thought, well, if I'm not really doing this, then why am I doing it at all? And then this version, the reason I call it the new Super Gamer Podcast, which is kind of an ode to the new Super Mario Bros. is because now, yeah, it came a point where I felt, you know, I got medicated and felt now I'm in a good space to do this and have generally, with the odd miss, done a weekly show since then. So yeah, I can empathize.
Cool. Yeah, it's fun times. It can be hard. I've definitely had that, like, well, you know, should I just be doing this at all thought, but I love doing it. I genuinely do. I really enjoy it. It's just that it's been hard to do things that I enjoy for the last while. And, you know, I'm still in the process of working that out and making it better. But it, you know, I want to do this, so I'm sticking to it. And hopefully, you know, there's a decent amount more content coming out soon than there has been for a little while. So
in your videos, you've always got a blackboard behind you with like all sorts of notes about, you know, video games and narrative and like arrows pointing at things. How often do you change what's written on that blackboard?
Not too often, partially because what's written on that blackboard and drawn on there is drawn by my partner. And they are, I mean, they also do the title cards, like, you know, the thumbnails for my videos and stuff. They're a big help. I could not do this without them, at least not to the same degree of quality. And I don't know. I ask a lot of them. They give so much to help to this in the first place. I don't really want to regularly be like, hey, could you like redo this? So, yeah, honestly, most of the changes that have come to that have come from moving. Because the first background, I think, was just like my video game shelf. but then the first time I actually had the blackboard background, it was when I was still living in California and living in a house provided to me by my work, because I was working with hydroelectric power plants up in the middle of nowhere and needed to be near them in case something went wrong, like in the middle of the night. Bad job, paid me well enough to pay off my student loan, so I appreciate it, but I didn't enjoy it. Surprisingly, an English major doesn't get a lot of fulfillment after a deal by, you know, driving an ATV out into a forest and turning on a hydroelectric power plant at 3 a.m. But while I was there, we painted one of the walls, because we did get permission for that, thankfully, with blackboard paint. And that was, you know, my background for the stuff that I was doing at that time. And since then, we just really liked that idea. So we kept that. When we moved to Tennessee, we could not just straight up paint the wall in the house that we were renting then. So we had like a facade built. We got some like a poster board or whatever. That's probably the wrong word. I'm not a hardware person. We basically just made like, you know, a fake wall to lean up against the wall, painted it with blackboard paint, then used that for a while. And then a couple years ago, we actually bought a house. And so, you know, I painted the wall in my office with that. And yeah, just to put all the stuff there. The thing that does change each time is that there's a small area, like just to the side of me, that always has the title of the video or the title of the game that we're talking about or something. Or in the case of my Spec Ops, the line analysis, occasionally distressing quotes from the game's loading screens. So yeah, that changes regularly, but the rest of it is fairly set up. I have actually been meaning to expand it, or, well, I guess more accurately, to ask Jimmy to, my partner, to expand it, but so that, you know, we can have a little bit more range of movement with the camera without getting into just, you know, plain blackboard wall. But we'll get to that sometime.
Are you aware, things have really come full circle for you here. Your The Damsel in Distress and Sex in Video Games videos are cited in an academic paper in Rebecca Elizabeth Compton's RPG Role-Playing Gender and How the Game Industry Has Sustained and Defied Sexism.
I don't think I knew that. I am aware that a couple of my videos have been used in that context or like in some classes and such, but I don't think I knew about that one in particular. That is interesting. I honestly have kind of mixed feelings on that specifically, because I was still on my journey away from conservative evangelicalism when I made that Sex in Video Games video. And I definitely, you know, there's a lot of sexism in there that is legitimate, but my perspective on sexuality and art in general is way different now than it was then. So there are elements of that video that I would do very differently were I doing them now, but still, that is cool. Well, it's always fun to see that, because, like, well, I don't know, I'm not going to pretend that I'm some sort of like trailblazing revolutionary, right? I'm not the first person to talk about video games as art on the internet, but there was less of it back when I started. And I do enjoy the idea that I seem to have played at least some degree of a role in the process of moving that idea further into the mainstream.
The other thing I'm wondering if you know about Did you know someone made a Civilization 5 mod in which they can you can play as you? You are one of the leaders of the world.
That is actually a friend of mine, yes. He did that. Yeah, I'd actually forgotten about that. Yeah, that was a fun one.
Your stats are your great works produce +2 faith. The palace has one writer specialist slot. All units have -10% combat strength. And the archaeologist can be purchased with faith and has +1 movement, but works slower.
Oh, gosh, that archaeologist thing actually is very on brand for me. Oh, boy.
I think that's amazing.
That is very fun. Yeah. Also, wow, you did your research into me before.
You mentioned it earlier. Can you give us a sneak peek at your Fatal Frame 3 analysis coming out this month?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, sure. A bit, at least. This is one of those games that I've been thinking about for a long time. So, like, I am replaying the game and getting, you know, going through it in more detail. But the general shape of my thoughts are already kind of formed. Fatal Frame is my favorite horror series, at least the original trilogy. I have mixed feelings on 4 and 5, but I love the hell out of them. I think they're brilliant and absolutely just traumatizingly scary. I played the first one. I marathoned the first one in one night with my cousin, drinking like pretty much nothing but Mountain Dew game fuel. And to this day, if I like even smell anything that smells like Mountain Dew game fuel smelled like, I get like flashback to Fatal Frame. It was just that scary. It imprinted itself on me. So yeah, I love these games very much. I've already talked about the first two, but 3 is my favorite of them, partially because it has a different framing device where the mansion that you're in is actually in your dreams. And you also have sequences just in your house, in, you know, the real world. And as sort of the scary stuff from those dreams starts to bleed into that, it leads to some really, really good, like, scary moments and just this general feeling that, like, nowhere is safe anymore in a really cool way. And 3 also is the one that I think is... This is a personal preference. I'm not a big fan of horror that... how to actually say this? I don't mind when horror stories end badly or like end in a sad way, like everyone dies or whatever. But I do want it to have a purpose, right? Like there are horror movies where that happens, but the story is constructed like a tragedy, right? This is the story of people who did not handle who were put in a tough situation and didn't handle it well. And this is how it turned out in the end. But there are others that are like, all right, here we go. We're going to figure this out. And then we're going to banish the ghost or whatever. Yay, we did. Oh, no, we didn't do it. It's just still here, I guess. Like the ending of Nightmare on Elm Street that the producers forced into it, where it's just like, hey, I know everything made sense and was wrapped up nice, but psych, I guess, for no reason. Or, yeah, I don't know. I just like the ambiguity or tragedy in my horror stories to also have logic within a narrative logic to them, I guess, not just like an in-universe logic, but to serve a narrative purpose. And the first, well, I kind of came around on the second Fatal Frame's approach to this when I did my video on it, but the first two of them still, like, they end pretty tragically, and I don't always feel like that's earned. I feel like in some ways it kind of, because a lot of the point of these games is, you know, oh, we're going to look at these ancient rituals that were horrific and awful. And it turns out actually, yeah, we're saving the world. Like they're kind of important. It almost affirms the things that it spent the entire game, you know, pointing out how grotesque and awful they are. And 3 doesn't do that at all. Like, it's just straight up like, no, this was bad. And the way that we're going to approach this is by attempting to bring a little bit of peace to the person who suffered from all of this. Like, it has, in the end, a much more, not just uplifting, because again, I don't need my horror stories to be uplifting in the end, but it has a lot of thematic cohesion, I suppose. Like, it comes together in a very satisfying way that feels consistent with what it's been doing so far, that ends on a note that really treats what happened as a bad thing and treats the response that we need to have to it to be a healing one. And I really like that. Like, I really, really love that more than what the first two games did. So I'm excited to talk about it in more detail because I yeah, I like Fatal Frame 3 a lot. It's a good one. Also, the ending scene has a Japanese song that is absolutely gorgeous. It's just called Koe, K-O-E, and it's really pretty. So that's a thing. But yeah.
Awesome. People can look out for that at youtube.com/@gameprof, and they can find your other work on there as well. Game Professor Sam, thank you for being here.
Yeah, of course. Always fun to talk about this sort of thing.